I would love to introduce our next speaker, and his name is Dr. Johnny Bowden. He, we're going to actually be talking about today the role of nutrition in autism, and he is just a wealth of knowledge, and I'm just so excited to have him here. So welcome, Johnny.
Oh, thanks. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here, and I really appreciate it. I was here last year, and I had a great time, and there's been a lot that I've learned personally in the last year, and I'm really eager to share it with this wonderful community, so thank you for having me.
Wonderful. You know, before we get started, though, I would love for those listening to maybe get a better idea of, you know, why you're so passionate about what you do.
Well, you know, I entered the field of health and nutrition as a second career. A lot of people know this. I was a professional musician, and I was as overweight and out of shape and unhealthy as you might expect. Someone who kind of grew up in the sex, drugs, and rock and roll era of Woodstock in the 60s. And, you know, I'd wake up and have a cup of coffee and a cigarette, and I thought that was a breakfast. And so I was kind of a health mess. I didn't have any life-threatening diseases, but I certainly was not headed in a good direction. And I got interested in health and fitness just out of boredom, actually. I would be traveling on the road with all these actors, and of course it's their job to stay in shape, and we'd have nothing to do during the daytime. And I just started hanging out with them and asking them to kind of teach me some of the basics of, you know, lifting weights. I mean, I was that naive. I barely knew what a bicep curl was. And I was one of those people who kind of got bitten by the bug and then became a zealot. I saw the changes that nutrition and exercise produced in my life, in my appearance, in my energy, and everything else. And I kind of wanted to go further with it. So I started looking into some kind of credentialing, and I picked up a certificate as a personal trainer. Now, I already had a master's in psychology, so I had some science background, but I wasn't really using it because I was, you know, working as a musician. So I looked to see if there was anything I could learn officially about nutrition and training. And so I became a certified personal trainer. And then I decided I liked that so much I wanted to get another certificate. And I wound up getting six of them. And interestingly, I was in New York City at the time conducting an off-Broadway show. And I happened to be passing in my neighborhood a new gym that was opening. And it looked really cool and classy, and it was hiring, and they were hiring people. And I thought, you know what? I mean, I just got the nerve. I've never trained a client in my life, but I certainly had been spending a few years working out and kind of learning everything I could and getting these certifications. So the name of the place was Equinox. And I thought, oh, this looks interesting. A new gym, maybe, you know, I'm going to go and give it a try. And I did. And I walked in and they hired me, God knows why. And I started on the floor of the very first Equinox that was ever built in New York City. Of course, everybody knows now it's one of the most successful national high-end club chains in the world. And that was how I began my career in fitness. Now, interestingly enough, the only nutrition I actually knew at the time was what they teach to personal trainers, which is so woefully horrendous, or was at the time, that, you know, but of course I didn't know that. So I basically swallowed the whole American Dietetic Association claptrap about low-fat diets and high-carb diets and obesity being just caused by too many calories and not enough time on the Stairmaster and all of these myths that have not only been completely debunked, but really did a lot of damage because they basically blamed the victim, because nobody knew at that time, or certainly nobody in the circles I was in, knew anything about hormones or vitamin deficiencies or environmental toxins and the disruption of liver function. And none of this was talked about. It was just the same old junk about calories and exercise, calories and exercise. And I was lucky enough to be present when we had a guest lecturer come and talk to the trainers at Equinox. His name was Barry Sears. I would guess many of your listeners know who Dr. Sears is. He's the author of the Zone books and a very prominent researcher in omega-3s. And at the time, he had just published his book. Nobody knew who he was. And here comes this MIT professor giving the trainers at Equinox a lecture. And he told us basically that everything we had been taught was nonsense. and that not only weight loss, but health was not determined by calories, but by hormones, and that food had a hormonal effect, and that what we ate actually drove our hormones in one direction or another, and that this is what we needed to be looking at, not calories, and that we needed to be eating a diet that was much more balanced, had a lot more fat in it. And this was pretty, this was just revolutionary. Anyone who's listening to this today, who's maybe under 30, can't even believe that this was controversial information, because everybody knows this now, or most people know this now. But we didn't know it then. I certainly didn't know it then. And I remember going up to Dr. Sears afterwards, and I said to him, "Dr. Sears, if what you say is true, then everybody else is wrong." And he, who is a wonderful man, he's been a mentor of mine for 20 years, he's not a modest man, and he looked at me and said, "Yes, Johnny, that's exactly right. Everybody else is wrong." And that started kind of a friendship, and what happened for me was I realized, boy, what I had been taught was just not it. And interestingly enough, as I began to investigate this stuff more and realize what we had done to our diets and our health by eliminating fat and eating all of these junky, high-processed carbohydrate foods and this high intake of omega-6 vegetable oils, which are pro-inflammatory, and you know all of these mistakes we were making, I just got very, very impassioned about correcting this because I saw the damage it was doing. Now, at the time, the damage I was looking at was people's weight and what it was doing, what this cockamamie low-fat diet was doing to people in terms of their bodies and their energy and stuff like that. Much later did I come to realize the damage it has done in terms of this diseases and health in general. But the problem was that what Dr. Sears had taught and what I later came to believe and what I believe to this day was very much out of the mainstream. And I realized pretty quickly that if I was going to speak with any authority, I better go back to school for nutrition. And that's exactly what I did. So a number of years later, I had a PhD in holistic nutrition as well as my master's degree, which gave me a certain amount of credibility. I got board certified, and this is not easy to do, I might add, by the Certifying Board of Nutrition Specialists, which is part of the American College of Nutrition. So I kind of became legit. And then I was able to say, "Guys, the emperor has no clothes, you're all wrong." And I've kind of been speaking, I would say, truth to power in the field of nutrition for many years. And I would guess that that is something that your audience can relate to, because so much of what this community shares in terms of information and tries in terms of protocols for their kids and conventional medicine just scoffs at. And to the audience, I say, keep doing it, because you're not going to get validation from conventional medicine. Of course, everybody has a theory about the whole vaccine thing. I have my own as well. But my point is that we've been bullied into believing a lot of claptrap when it comes to medications, when it comes to food, when it comes to supplementation. And I don't like bullies. And that's where my passion comes from. And I don't care if they're dietitians or if they're conventional doctors who scoff at anything that you bring in that isn't, you know, prescribed by the pharmaceutical companies. And that's kind of what fires me up to try to empower people to look at alternatives and to what their doctors have told them. Not that we should dismiss what our doctors tell us, but we need to start being the leader of our own health team. We need to start taking a much more active role. When I was a kid, my parents were of the generation that the doctor knows best. And if the doctor didn't say it, it didn't exist. And if the doctor did say it, you didn't question it. I would like to explode that way of thinking and get people to be a lot more proactive in making their choices about their health and their bodies. And that's where my passion comes from.
Well, and I think that all the listeners right now, gosh, we are so lucky to have somebody of your wealth of knowledge to learn from. And, you know, especially with autism being, you know, as high as it is today, you know, it's 1 in 68 and 1 in 42 boys. You know, we hear a lot about these days about the connection between the gut and the brain. What's your thoughts on that?
It cannot be overestimated. If you've heard about that and you're thinking, well, maybe there's a little, no, there's a, the connection is so strong, so powerful, that it's almost impossible to overstate it. A lot of research these days in nutrition, possibly one of the hottest topics in nutrition these days and probably for the next decade, is something called the microbiome. Now, what does that big word mean? It's the name scientists give to the entire ecological system that lives in your gut. We've heard, maybe you haven't heard, but we now know that there are more non-human cells in and on your body than there are human ones. There's some debate about how many more, but it's at least three times as many. And those are microbes, and they live in your gut, they live on your skin, but primarily in your gut, bacteria, fungi, all kinds of microbes, and the balance of those microbes, the diversity of those microbes, the health of those microbes has now been shown to affect schizophrenia, depression, weight gain. I mean, the list goes on and on. Every conference I go to, there's another one that they have shown a connection to gut health. So we now know, I don't think there is any controversy that about the fact that the health of the gut impacts just about every area of health and vitality that you can imagine.
Absolutely. I know with my son, it's, you know, what he eats has a direct effect on how he acts, feels, and behaves. And
no question.
And I think that's, you know, the old myth of, you know, you are what you eat is not a myth.
You are what you eat, it's also you are what you absorb, and it is also you are what the bacteria in your gut eat. So what we have to remember is that not only are some foods really bad for us, but they're also bad in terms of feeding that gut population. Some foods feed the bad guys. I'll give you one example of a bad guy that everybody knows, yeast. We've all heard of yeast infections. Most of us have heard of candida, which is the actual bug that the yeast bug, if you will, that can cause great overgrowth in the body. And this is not uncommon also in kids with autism. So when you're eating sugar, guess what they feed on? Sugar. And when you want to starve them, you go on a low sugar diet, and that's always been the prescription for a candida diet, is to lower all the foods that candida thrive on. So the condition of your gut is influenced by your food, as are you, and this can have profound downstream effects on kids' behavior, our ability to gain weight, brain fog, inflammation, which I hope we'll get into later because that is such an important part of what we're talking about. Immune deficiency, all of these things can be powerfully influenced by the food choices that we make.
Now, we, you know, some people, this might be controversial, the vaccine issue, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely controversial in autism. I typically don't talk about it, but I know it's one that many people are curious about. You have a specific theory on this and that you've talked about a lot in your articles.
I do have a point of view about this, and I'll tell you what it is.
Okay.
And what you also have to understand before I tell you what my point of view on this is that what we're trying to balance here, and I understand why conventional medicine gets so up in arms when, you know, the anti-vaxxers, you know, they call us all, they're all crazy, and it's just a bunch of crazy people who, you know, there's no science to support it. And part of the reason for that, it's besides the fact that they're pretty narrow-minded about some of these things, is that there really would be a public health crisis if everybody stopped vaccinating. And I can understand that from a public health point of view, they do not want people kind of spreading this notion. But I have a kind of bipartisan view of this, and it's one that I think both sides could accept, and I do not understand for the life of me why more people aren't talking about it. So here's what my point of view is. You have a liver. Your liver has a major job, which is to detoxify toxins, to get them out of the body. The liver does this in two phases. There's phase one detoxification and phase two detoxification, and it is done through a series of enzymes called the cytochrome P450 enzymes. And that enzyme system is responsible for first isolating the toxins, getting them, conjugating them or mixing them with something else so that they can actually become water-soluble and be excreted from the body. And that's the job of the liver. Now, we know from copious research going back to the 50s, that there are enormous differences from person to person in all kinds of things. The size of the thyroid gland, the number of isles of isolates that produce insulin in the pancreas, the size of the testes, the size of the ovaries. There's almost not a metric in human health that doesn't have a very wide variation, even among normal people. Okay? I cannot for the life of me understand why someone hasn't said, you know what? There are probably big variations in the cytochrome P450 enzyme system. And some people may be more effective at detoxifying than others. And some people may have challenges with detoxifying certain things that others don't. It is my theory that there is a subset of kids whose cytochrome P450 enzyme system doesn't work quite right and can easily be overwhelmed by something that a normal kid's enzyme system wouldn't even bat an eyelash at. So, you know, we all know people with peanut allergies. I mean, I can eat peanuts and not a single thing happens. They just work fine in my system. Other people will go into anaphylactic shock. So we obviously, there is a, so would you say that peanuts cause? No, they don't cause it in everybody. They certainly don't in me. I can munch on them all day long. But they will in certain susceptible people. And what I think is that this argument about vaccines has been framed in the wrong way. Do vaccines cause autism? Well, no more than peanuts cause anaphylactic shock, but they do in some people. And I think that the bipartisan approach to this should be investigating differences in our detoxification pathways in the liver. We know that there are these differences in every other system in the body. Why would there not be differences in our detoxification system, which consists of two phases and hundreds of enzymes? Of course there are going to be differences, and some kids may be overwhelmed by the particular cocktail that's given in vaccinations, and it is certainly possible that that could be one of the root causes that kind of, you know, upsets the apple cart. Not for everybody, but for some, and I think that's where we need to be looking.
You had said, you said P450 enzyme system?
The cytochrome, it's called cytochrome, C-Y-T-O-C-H-R-O-M-E, cytochrome P, as in Paul, 450 enzyme system. Every one of us has it.
Now, is there a way to test that system prior to vaccination?
That's beyond my pay scale. I don't know. I mean, I know that there are tests for just about everything, and certainly I would be surprised if there wasn't a way of testing that.
Or they need to be testing it, right?
But I think we should be looking there, because a variation in the ability to detox would account for why a substance that's innocuous for 9 kids is not innocuous for the 10th.
Yeah. Now, in your opinion, when you did talk about inflammation, right?
Talk about inflammation.
And so, like, what, you know, a lot of that goes to, you know, what the child's eating as well. What's your ideal diet to help with the inflammation and just, you know, overall inflammation itself when it comes to autism spectrum?
Kristen, could we maybe just back up 1 second and talk about what inflammation is and why it is a concern?
Oh, perfect. Yeah, absolutely.
So, because I will tell you one factoid, inflammation and immune system dysregulation or immune system, you know, problems are very, very common in autism. Now, inflammation is very common in the general population, but it's really common in autism. So we need to pay attention to inflammation. Now, when I talk about inflammation to a lay audience, people usually think, oh, yeah, that's like when I have a pain, you know, or like when I get an abscess in my tooth, it's all inflamed, or, you know, I get a splinter and it swells up and, you know, that's inflammation. And they're right. But that's one flavor of inflammation. It's called acute inflammation, and it doesn't really harm you. It hurts, but it doesn't kill. The inflammation you and I are talking about, which does contribute to serious degenerative diseases and promote just about everything else you don't want to happen, is called chronic inflammation. And chronic inflammation flies beneath the pain radar. You will never know you have it. It happens in the vascular system. It happens in the brain. It happens in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. They see inflammation. It happens in arthritis. It happens. It sometimes it goes with acute inflammation, so you can both hurt and be inflamed in your arteries at the same time. So inflammation is really a major promoter of everything. And here's a real connection, potential connection to autism. When you have a lot of inflammation in the gut, it often leads to a kind of weakening of the gut wall. And we call that, in integrative medicine, we call that leaky gut syndrome. And what it basically means is your gut has a wonderful protective lining that keeps stuff that doesn't belong from getting into the bloodstream. And you could think of that lining as kind of a cheesecloth. Well, with lots of inflammation, or by eating foods that produce inflammation, particularly in the gut, that cheesecloth starts to get some holes in it. It's not so strong. It's not so tightly woven. There are little sections where stuff can fit through and get in. And that's what happens with leaky gut. Undigested peptides that shouldn't be going into the bloodstream can now fit through those holes in the cheesecloth. All kinds of other things can fit through the holes in the cheesecloth. It doesn't work as good as a barrier. Now you've got things floating around in your bloodstream that the body doesn't recognize and starts to mount an immune system attack on. And this is very, very common in autism, which should be yet another reason to be very careful about diet, because diet is a huge promoter of inflammation.
Now that we know that diet's a huge promoter, right, what is the ideal diet, you think, for somebody on the spectrum?
Well, let's take one factor in that diet, fats. There are two classes of fats that everybody should be aware of. There are other classes. There's monounsaturated and saturated and all that stuff. But the two classes of fats that I want people to be aware of for the purpose of this talk is omega-6 and omega-3. Now, omega-6 is an essential fatty acid. Both of them are. But omega-6 is pro-inflammatory, and omega-3 is anti-inflammatory. Now, the interesting fact is that you need both inflammatory compounds in your body and anti-inflammatory. And people always say, what do I need the inflammatory ones for? Well, you get an infection. You get a fever. You get some swelling. You get some white blood cells surrounding the area trying to protect a puncture wound from allowing a microbe in. That's inflammation. It's part of the healing process. You need to be able to produce inflammatory compounds. The problem is that we consume 16 times more pro-inflammatory omega-6 than we do anti-inflammatory omega-3. No wonder there is an epidemic of inflammation, and no wonder it is a part and parcel of every disease and a really big concern in autism. So the correction for that is very simple. Throw out your vegetable. Well, I wouldn't say throw out your vegetable. I'm being a little dramatic. But stop using all this corn oil and safflower oil and canola oil and soybean oil. These are high omega-6 vegetable oils that really don't do you a lot of good. You're not going to be deficient in them because you can't shake a stick in a grocery store without, you know, getting 50 products that all have used omega-6 in the making of those products. So you'll get plenty of it. But the problem is we're getting way too much of it and not enough of the anti-inflammatory omega-3. So number one with a bullet, you should probably supplement with omega-3s and cut back with on your vegetable oil intake. That would be the first thing. And you can do that in a whole different kind of diets. That's compatible with all kinds of dietary programs, but it really is a cornerstone here of reducing inflammation. Stop with so much vegetable oil and start supplementing with omega-3s. Now, people ask sometimes, particularly with kids, and we have kids in our family, I was like, they don't like to take pills. They don't like fish oil. They don't like the idea that it's fish oil. So there is really a solution to that. Barleen's, which is a wonderful company that I've known of and worked with in one way or the other for almost a decade, makes omega-3s in a formulation called swirls, and they taste almost like candy. They are, the omega-3s are kind of mixed in with a kind of fruit compote, and it's quite easy to digest and very easy to take, and it comes in wonderful flavors. So if you can't get your kid to take omega-3 pills, for God's sake, or you know, swallow a tablespoon of fish oil, which is going to be pretty hard, it's going to be a heavy lift for most kids, use the swirls. That's your answer.
I love that. And
now, that did not answer all the question about the rest of the diet, but it certainly starts with one of the fundamental things, which is you've got to reduce inflammation.
Well, and when you're talking about the swirls, you can get that at most health food stores. So it's
easy to
obtain. You know, because that's
every
usually the question.
Yeah.
So now, where would you talk about diet, though? Do you have an ideal diet for children?
Well, I would take out the usual suspects when it comes to inflammatory response. I do not believe that every human being on the planet is gluten sensitive, but I do believe that a way larger proportion of the population is than we've been led to believe. And gluten really has no benefit to anybody. It's either neutral or it's bad. It's never good. And because we're so concerned about inflammation, and because there is such a high percentage of kids and of people, you know, adults who are gluten sensitive in one way or the other, I think that would kind of be my first order of business, was get the gluten out. And by the way, here's the big mistake with gluten-free diets. People buy, you may remember from the 80s, the low-fat movement. We were all eating snack wall cookies. Well, what do you think they replace that sugar with when they took the fat out of the cookies? What do you think they replaced it with? They replaced it with sugar. They replaced it with other horrible artificial ingredients. So you had a horrible snack, the snack wall cookie, but it didn't have any fat. Well, we're kind of doing the same thing with gluten. We're taking foods that have no real benefit for you, crappy cereals like Captain Crunch and all this other stuff. So we take the gluten out and we substitute for it a tapioca flour or something else that also screws up blood sugar, doesn't add any particular nutrition. So it's not enough to simply eat gluten-free foods or foods that have been engineered to have the gluten taken out. You can eat gluten-free by eating foods that never had gluten in the first place, rather than trying to find a chemical substitute for one junk food and replacing it with another junk ingredient. Vegetables never had gluten. Fruits never had gluten. Meat, grass-fed meat, never had gluten. Wild-caught fish never had gluten. Nuts never had gluten. You can eat gluten-free without touching any of these manufactured, processed gluten-free foods, and that would be, you know, to me, the ideal place to start.
I always tell parents when they get kind of nervous about looking at gluten-free or even dairy-free, I say to them, have you been in the produce section or the meat department? Because for the most part, that's the gluten-free and dairy-free. So, you know, I think sometimes we make it too complicated for ourselves. I really believe.
If you asked me, in case we don't get to this and we want to take home on diet right now, I think this is the most important dietary principle in the world, and it's really simple. Eat real food. Now, what does that mean? Because a lot of people don't know what real food really looks like or means. It means that my definition of real food is food that your great-grandmother would have recognized. She does not. Your great grandmother came back to Earth on this day. She would not know what a Lunchable is. She would not know what a box of juice is. She would not know what the cereal aisle with the thousands of, you know, Captain Crunch and Cocoa this, and she would not know what that is. So the first order of business is actual real food. That's food that would spoil if you put it outside, food that would go bad, food that actually has some color in it. That's real food. It's as simple as that. And my rule of thumb, because many people say, well, is this real food? But what about this? And there's a lot of things that seem to be sort of on the border of real food. My answer to them is, if you have to ask, put it in the not real food department, because the real foods are that obvious, you know. And if there's a question, err on the side of safety and get rid of it.
If you don't see it growing in a garden, most likely it's not real food. food.
Well, I always used to use, when I lectured, I used to always say, eat from the Johnny Bowden four food groups, which were food you could hunt, fish, gather, or pluck. It's really simple.
That is actually very simple.
Right.
Now, in your two books, The Great Cholesterol Myth and Smart Fat, you speak very highly of the coenzyme Q10. What is coQ10? And why is it so important?
CoQ10 is a nutrient that's found in every single cell in the body. And it's very important for heart health. It's actually important for energy. It's kind of an energy factory for the cell. And we think of it so much as a heart nutrient because the heart uses a lot of energy. It's on 24 hours a day. It never takes a rest. It beats, 60 beats a minute for 24/7, 365 days. So it needs a lot of energy. And that's why we always think of CoQ10 as such an important nutrient for the health. But CoQ10 is also important for a substance called, I'm going to use a big word here. It's called the mitochondria. The mitochondria are simply the energy factories in the cell. And you need healthy mitochondria in order to function, in order to have cellular energy, mental energy, any kind of energy is produced in the cell, and it requires coenzyme Q10. And there definitely seems to be some connection with CoQ10 deficiency, and I would think that that would be a pretty important supplement for most kids. And once again, luckily, there is a swirl version, also made by Barleans, of CoQ10, and you certainly can't go wrong with that. They actually flavored it with coconut. It's actually pretty good.
Now, how would the CoQ10 help address the needs of that child on the spectrum that might have been diagnosed with mitochondrial dysfunction?
That's a pretty complicated biochemical discussion, and I'm not sure that I have all the data in front of me to really make that clear and concise and understandable. But I think we should just leave with the takeaway here is that CoQ10 is important for cellular energy, and many of these functions are compromised in our kids. And I'll tell you something else that's compromised. I mentioned earlier that inflammation and immune system dysfunction are very, very common in autism. I just did a webinar on low thyroid, and it was one of the big takeaways from that was that 95% of people who have low thyroid, and I know this isn't necessarily relevant to our discussion right now, but it's an example that I think is very important. 95% of people with low thyroid actually don't have a thyroid disorder. They have an autoimmune disorder, and it's called Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And it is an autoimmune disease. And here's the thing about autoimmune diseases, and this is what is relevant to everyone listening. Autoimmune diseases have triggers. So it is kind of like, when you trigger the activity of the immune system and you have an autoimmune disease, the immune system is not all that good at selecting what it should be attacking. That's what makes it an autoimmune disease. See, in normal immunity, a foreign object comes into the body like bacteria or something like that, and the immune system jumps into play and it produces antibodies to that, and everything is good. But in an autoimmune disease, the immune system gets confused. It's kind of like friendly fire. It sees the thyroid tissue and it thinks it's a foreign object and starts attacking it. Well, what are the kinds of things that can trigger autoimmune diseases? Well, gluten is one of them. Any kind of real stress or any kind of toxin, any of these things that kind of them to jump into action, if it gets overstimulated, if things start triggering it, that it begins to attack everything, and you have all kinds of downstream, collateral damage. So you got to look at the triggers. Well, what are the triggers? Very frequently, it's gluten. Very frequently, it's some of the foods that that people are the most sensitive to, like soy and even sometimes eggs, but certainly wheat, dairy, and sugar would be at the top of the list. So we really need to start looking at how we can not just eliminate autism through diet, because I don't know that we can eliminate it, but what we can do is we can really modify a lot of the triggers that probably make symptoms worse. And that's what I think the takeaway should be. I certainly hope it's possible. I hope some genius researcher figures it out. I don't know that we can reverse autism. I do know that we can do a lot to modify the triggers that make all the symptoms so much worse.
And, you know, anytime there's progress, that's a good thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is the role of fermented foods in the diet of a child with autism in your opinion?
Well, great, great question. Thank you for asking it. So the whole buzz about fermented foods, the reason that they get such, they're so golden in the health community, why people talk about them all the time and why they're so valuable, goes back to that question about the microbiome. So if you think of the microbiome, there's thousands of species of bacteria in the microbiome, but let's just think of them as good guys and bad guys, just for the sake of simplicity. There are, you know, there are bacteria and microbes in the microbiome in the gut that are very good for us, and there are many that are not very good for us. Fermented foods have probiotics, which are the good guys of the gut ecology. So the more you can take in through the diet, probiotics, the good bacteria that help ease out the bad guys. That, you know, think of the, if you think of your gut garden as kind of a regular garden, there's weeds and there's roses, right? And you want less weeds and more roses. And the thing about weeds is when they start to get overgrown, they kind of push out everything else, and you wind up having a garden full of weeds because they're strong, like cockroaches. They survive, and they'll knock out everything else that's around. So you really need to constantly be replenishing the gut with the good guys, with the seeds of roses, not the seeds of weeds. And that's what fermented foods do. So naturally fermented sauerkraut. And the problem, of course, is a lot of these traditional foods like sauerkraut and olives that are fermented in their own juices and soy sauce, which used to always be fermented, they're now often made chemically. So you buy a jar of olives, it's been chemically fermented. Soy sauce isn't fermented anymore, or, unless you go to, you know, get a really traditional source. Same with sauerkraut, all of these foods. But to the extent that you can get naturally fermented foods, and sauerkraut and olives would be among them, you know, the olives that you see in an olive bar when they're just sitting out in the air and they're kind of fermenting in their own juice, those are fermented. But, of course, the ones we know the best are yogurt and kefir, which are wonderful sources of probiotics. Please don't get the low-fat yogurt, for God's sake. So you want kefir and yogurt, which I don't, you know, I don't have young children, so I can't tell. We have 13-year-olds, and I can tell you that they're a handful when it comes to eating and taste and stuff like that. So I can understand that there may be some challenges getting kids to eat these foods, but you need to know how important they really are. And there are probiotic supplements that you can take also, which I would recommend very highly.
Now, you talked about the high fat, you know, low fat or whatever, saying yeah. that's not good. What do you think a high fat diet is appropriate for kids in general, or for kids with autism in particular?
I think everything should be on a case-by-case basis, but what I think is not healthy for kids with autism or any other kids on the planet is a high-processed carb diet, which is what we feed most kids in America. So you got to substitute something for that high amount of processed carbs. To some extent, protein, very important, but you don't need much more than 15 to 20% of your calories from protein, maybe a little bit more, not terribly much more. So if you're really cutting back on the processed carb, what are you going to substitute? And that's where fat comes in. It's a wonderful source of energy. It doesn't have any sugar. It doesn't cause your insulin to spike. It won't cause the behavioral changes that sugar does. So I would say a higher fat diet than most of us have been exposed to or have been recommended to most of us, a higher amount of fat than that. Two wonderful sources, coconut oil. Just the best stuff in the world. And the coconut oil also helps the body to produce ketones, which are very, very good energy source for the brain. So there's a lot of really brilliant neurologists, and I will mention my particular hero in the integrative neurology world, which is a guy named David Perlmutter, who wrote a couple of wonderful books, The Grain Brain Diet Plan and Grain Brain and stuff like that, that really trace a lot of neurological problems to excessive grain use and excessive sugar. And these guys really recommend high-fat diets for just about everything. And by the way, Perlmutter is a thin, wiry guy who runs all the time, and he is constantly on a low-fat diet. on a high fat diet. So, you know, I'm not a neurologist. I would never want to give any prescribing information to parents with kids on the spectrum, but I would tell you to definitely investigate it. And it seems to me that higher amounts of fat have a lot to recommend them in the diet of kids on the spectrum, and all kids actually. And coconut is a wonderful way to go with that.
When you're talking about good fat and bad fat, you know, I think, can we maybe elaborate a little bit on that? Because there's some people that maybe just don't understand there's good fat and bad fat kind of stuff that you might be thinking
sure.
about.
Sure. The problem that I have found is that many people have finally gotten the message that there is such a thing as good fat and bad fat, but they have not gotten the message about what that is. So we kind of know now, even the most reactionary 1950s dietitian will admit that there's good fat, like the fat in fish. But they will continue to say that all saturated fat is bad, which is absolutely not true. So what makes a fat good or bad for me, and what I have written about in the book Smart Fat, for example, is that what makes it, there's only one criteria by which you judge whether a fat is good or bad. Is it toxic? That's it. So when you eat the saturated fat that comes from factory farmed cows, those cows have been fed grain, which is not their natural diet, which makes their stomach acid. Those cows have been fed antibiotics, which winds up in their fat. Those cows have been fed bovine growth hormone, which winds up in their fat. And those cows have been fed, as I mentioned, grain, which has been sprayed with pesticides and Roundup Ready this and that, and, you know, every kind of fungicide and pesticide and that you can imagine, all of which winds up in their fat. Yes, if you're talking about meat from McDonald's or meat from the supermarket that comes from factory farms, you better eat low fat. Cut that fat away. It's really bad for you. But it's not bad for you because it's saturated. It's bad for you because it comes from toxic animals. When I go to the farmer's market and they have genuine grass-fed cow meat that was raised humanely on small farms, and they were never fattened on grain, and they, you know, really wandered around the grass, poking around at insects and getting omega-3s from their natural food, like grasses and insects and all the other things that they kind of chew on their cud. And they ask, do you want the low-fat kind? So I say, are you kidding? I'll take the highest-fat kind you have, because there is nothing to fear from it, even though it's saturated, because it's not toxic. So stop thinking, please, everybody, stop thinking in terms of good fat and bad fat being saturated versus unsaturated, and start thinking of it in terms of toxic versus non-toxic, because that's the only thing that really matters.
I think that's a great that's a great way to understand it, and hopefully the listeners are getting that. And I think you know, just growing up, it's like, you know, just like you were talking about, there was all these myths of all those different things, the low fat and the bad fat, and now, yep, you know, I think we're finally getting it, which is great. Now, are there any other diet programs that you might suggest to parents to investigate in?
Well, I really do think that anything that kind of that concentrates on the gut, I don't want to necessarily proselytize for any basic diet program. I think it really comes down to real food, and there's so many, you know, individual concerns with, you know, taste and what the kid will and won't eat and stuff like that. But if you kind of just keep going back to the fundamentals of real food, it's really hard to go wrong. I think the exact proportion of fat and carbohydrate and protein is less important than that the food all be real. Listen, there are native people, the Bantu of South Africa, who eat like 80% carbohydrates, but they don't eat carbohydrates we would recognize over here. They don't come from the grocery store. They're little bitter fruits that grow and little, you know, plants and stuff that they pluck from. So they're carbohydrates, but they're real food and they're non-toxic. And that is really probably what matters more. Now, I do want to say one thing about vitamins and supplements. We know that there are certain vitamin deficiencies that are very common in kids with autism. One of them is vitamin A. And interestingly enough, vitamin A requires zinc in order to really be absorbed and get where it's supposed to go and do all the good stuff that it does. Now, zinc is highly involved in taste. And many kids, and this is not only those in the spectrum, but kids in general, or people in general, who are very picky eaters, or they, you know, they don't taste things well, or they don't know what, often have zinc deficiencies. So I would look very carefully at zinc and vitamin A as something to be sure that your kid is getting the right amounts of. And many of them may need zinc supplementation, which, by the way, you can get in a liquid as well as a pill. And so that's something that I think is worth mentioning. In addition, of course, to the omega-3s and the coenzyme Q10 and the other stuff that we talked about as well.
I think the parents listening are getting so much information. And, you know, if they want to learn more about you and your books and you know, just keep following you, where's all your information? I know you have a website and Twitter and
website
things like that.
Sure. My website is johnnyboden.com, JONNYBODEN. I'm at Johnny Boden on Twitter and Dr. Johnny Boden on Facebook. And remember, there's no H in Johnny.
There's no H in Johnny. You should make a T-shirt that says that if you don't have one
already. That's really good.
And so, and then they can find your books on your website and probably.
No, they're all on Amazon.
And Amazon, I was going to say.
All my books are on Amazon. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. And then, what message? Because we talked about a lot. What message do you want parents to leave parents with, and want parents to know?
I want you to be empowered. I want you to stop thinking your doctor knows everything. And that doesn't mean that if you have a wonderful doctor who's trained in functional medicine or a licensed naturopath or one of these, you know, really good guys in the – and by saying good guys, I mean obviously male and female, but the good guys in the medical profession who really do look at into every little crevice and look at how the body functions and don't reach for a prescription pad at, you know, for every single symptom. It doesn't mean you should ignore them. But you should not, I don't want parents feeling the way my parents felt, that the doctor knows best. What you share in your community, what you try out, often works. And when it does, share that information. It may not work for every kid, but you've got to be your own experimenter with this. You can't wait for a randomized double-blind control study for every single vitamin, every single supplement, every single dietary intervention. You can't. You're going to have to try some of that your own. You know, I get sent a lot of books as I review books for different, you know, websites and for my own thing. And I recently got one called The N of One, which is a physician who was diagnosed with cancer. And this is not the only book like this. And there's actually a one that goes back about 10 years called called Anti-Cancer. And these are scientists. These are doctors who got diagnosed with cancer. And you know what? They didn't have time to wait 20 years for the double-blind studies to come in. So they started doing their own research, just like every parent listening to this is doing. They talked to people. They found out what worked. They heard other people's experience. Was that randomized control, you know, first-class science? No, it wasn't, but it was useful. It was useful evidence, and they were open-minded to hear it, and they tried it. And in both these cases, they lived way beyond what the doctors told them they were going to live with their cancer diagnosis. So we got to do the same kind of thing. We can't necessarily follow this rigorous, you know, almost worshipful religion-like thing about it's science. There's no science for this. There's not a lot of science for a lot of things. My great nutrition mentor used to say, the entire New York City Fire Department does not have a single randomized double-blind study showing that water puts out fire. They've just noticed that it works. Notice what works and believe in it.
I love that. That is such a great message. I so appreciate you taking the time to help our families, and the help is so much needed, as you know. And I know that our families got so much out of this. And, you know, thank you for inspiring us and to helping us remember that there's hope.
Thank you so much. Thank you. There's always hope. Thank you.